This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation. And how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 16th of October. The government has announced an independent review into the tens of millions of pounds of carers' allowance overpayments. We speak to one of the full-time carers affected and to the politician and carer, Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey. As the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill is introduced in Parliament, we speak to the actor and disability rights campaigner Liz Carr, who is opposed to assisted dying legislation. Also, an emotional return to Sudan. We hear from the winner of this year's Sterling Prize for Architecture and speak to the composer of the original score for tonight's first screening in a century of three silent Sherlock Holmes films. They were forced to pay back thousands, in some cases tens of thousands of pounds, pushing many of them into debt and distress. They are full-time carers who are getting a carer's allowance, that's a benefit, currently worth £81.90 a week, but were forced to repay it in full when their weekly earnings exceeded, even by a few pence, the permitted limit of £151. Critics have called this a cruel cliff edge for a group of people whose lives are already filled with far more stress and anxiety than most. And today the government announced an independent review into the overpayments. The Work and Pensions Secretary, Liz Kendall, said her department was determined to put this right. Well, one of the full-time carers who have been affected is Emma Martin from Devon. She cares for her 27-year-old daughter, Mia.
Mia was diagnosed around 22 months old, and I've obviously been caring for her since she was born, and I'm still caring for her now. So she's a full-time job, 24/7. I've always been getting carer's allowance.
And tell us about what happened when you discovered you had been overpaid.
I literally received a letter saying that I'd owed about £1,500 back to the DWP because I'd earned too much money. I'd been working as a nursery teacher, and it was something ridiculous, like 50p a week over a period of months.
You were 50p over what's permitted before you lose your carer's allowance entirely?
Yeah, that was enough. If it had been 10 pence, it would have been enough.
You had to pay the whole amount back?
Yeah, I had to pay. I lost all my carers. I didn't pay the 50p back. I had to lose all the carers for however many weeks it was, you know, because obviously you get paid monthly. So if it had been going on for 4 or 5 months, you would lose that monthly carer's allowance. You would lose the whole lot. So if it was £250 a month back then, carer's allowance, for the sake of 50p, you would lose the whole £250.
Did you have that money?
No. I borrowed it from family. And I suppose with hindsight, like everything else, I'd have turned around and said, well, I don't actually have it. You know, you can have it a pound a week or something. But at the time, it was so, it was such a shock, really. It's a bit like getting a speeding fine or some prosecution thing through the post. You just feel the anxiety that goes through you and you just sort of panic and ask why.
So what do you make of the fact that the government's now going to have this independent review into the overpayments, such as the one you got?
I think it's a minuscule drop in the ocean. Obviously, I'm happy that something's being done, but on the grand scale of carers and how we're treated and what we're paid, you know, you go out to work to earn money so you can live. And then if you earn one pence over your allowance, you're penalised for it. And we can't win for trying.
When it comes to the money, though, which is what this review is looking at, what do you hope will happen? That the money you had taken away will be returned in full, or what?
Yeah, I mean, those people that have been sent letters out saying they owe money, I think it's absolutely disgusting. And I think it should all be written off. Do you know how hard it is to care and to go out to work as well? It's really hard. And there's days I'm on my knees and I don't want to go, but I have to because I can't afford the £80 a week.
Emma Martin, who cares for her 27-year-old daughter, Mia. The BBC's social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan, has been telling me about the scale of the problem.
It's been calculated a few months ago that there were 134,000 people who had been overpaid carers' allowance, and that it's estimated that they owe the government £250 million, £250 million in benefit that they had received that the government says they weren't eligible for. And a lot of the people who have been caught up on this simply inadvertently ended up claiming the benefit. Not everybody, of course, but an awful lot of them, because the rules are incredibly harsh, they would argue, which is that if you earn more than £151 a week, a penny over that, you have to pay the entire benefit back. And several years ago, the Department of Work and Pensions knew that this was an issue, so they entered into an agreement with HMRC, the tax authorities, so that they could get access to tax authority data. When somebody's payroll showed that they were earning more than the threshold, the DWP would get an alert from HMRC. Now, these alerts have been going to the DWP for a number of years, but the department simply hasn't been checking them all and not actioning them all. The DWP, while they put processes in place, simply didn't follow them up. And if they had done, they would have been able to alert the claimants who aren't eligible for the benefit any longer. They would have been able to alert them a lot earlier, and the level of debt that they built up simply wouldn't have been as high.
Do we know roughly what the parameters of this review are going to be, though? What is it looking at? Is it very narrowly looking at the financial aspects of the overpayments, or is it looking perhaps more holistically at the issue?
Liz Kendall, the Work and Pension Secretary, said that the terms of reference will be announced after some discussion, so they haven't been finalised yet. In broad terms, what the government said was that they were going to look at how the overpayments had happened, how the department had responded to them, and what could be done to support carers going forward. And that's, I think, the phrase that a lot of the carers groups are hoping to hang on to try and see if the government would be open to having a broader look at carers' allowance rather than simply, though importantly, looking at the overpayments.
The BBC's social affairs correspondent, Michael Buchanan. Well, we're joined now by a Member of Parliament who has a particular interest in this issue, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey, who acted as his mother's carer when he was a boy and now cares for his own severely disabled son. He raised the issue of carer overpayments at Prime Minister's Questions today. Good evening, Sir Ed.
Good evening.
What would you like this review to do?
Well, I'd like it to both sort out the repayment scandal, but also go much more broadly and sort out all the problems in the badly designed carers allowance system. You heard from Emma, who'd been caring for her daughter Mia, how the cliff edge within the carers allowance system works in so disastrous. She's been penalised just for working as a nursery teacher. And it beggars belief that anyone can think this system works. So I welcome the review. We've been campaigning as Liberal Democrats, working with carers organisations, working with people in the media like the Guardian newspaper to get this sorted. But I worry that a review could be used to kick it down the road. We've seen that before with the Conservatives.
So what are you after? Are you after all these overpayments or the repayments that have been requested being written off?
Yeah, I think, I mean, unless there's an example of grotesque fraud, and there may be one or two examples of that, but the vast majority have been unintentional and been the fault, frankly, the DWP's own incompetence. So, yes, the vast majority of these overpayments should be written off. But we also, as Liberal Democrats, want to see the whole care allowance system reviewed, getting rid of the cliff edge, for example.
So you think out of that approximately £250 million of overpayments, you're confident that only a few of those are down to some truly fraudulent cases, are you?
Yeah, we had a very interesting example in the House of Commons today in the debate that Liberal Democrats caused, which I think triggered this decision by the government to announce the review. I intervened on the former Conservative Secretary of State for the Department of Work and Pensions, and I'd asked him, had he asked his officials how much of this overpayment was down to fraud and how much it was down to a small amount over the earnings limit. And he had to admit, although he hadn't really researched it, that he felt it was the vast majority was down to this earnings limit and this cliff edge. So that backs the point up that Liberal Democrats have been making for some time.
So when
the repayments should be written off.
So when you say the cliff edge needs to go, what would you like to see? I mean, if someone inadvertently is, you know, £1 over the limit, they pay... just repay the £1 back? Do they rather? I mean, if you look at the figures, they are pretty stark, aren't they? Now, a carer who earns £1 more over the threshold, say over 52 weeks, if they paid that back, it would be £52. If they had to pay back their entire carer's allowance, it's £4,258.80.
Yeah, crazy. This is crazy. It is utterly crazy, isn't it? Just when you say that. I mean, the first thing I do actually is raise the earnings limit, and that could get rid of a lot of these problems. But I still think there's a very strong case for a taper when you go over the earnings limit, even a higher earnings limit. And we had this debate in the Commons. I was a bit worried, I'll be honest with you. The minister seemed to be reading his brief and seemed to be against a taper approach. But I think many of the independent experts have looked at this, and the carers organisations think we need a taper approach so you don't have this cliff edge.
You say you want a broader review into payments for carers. A point has been made that actually the structure of the carer's allowance has been relatively unchanged since 2010, which of course includes a time when you were in government in the coalition. So do you accept part of the blame?
Well, the problem actually hadn't really emerged until a few years ago. If you remember, there was the real trigger was some evidence that the Select Committee took in 2018. So the problem got a lot worse afterwards. But I have to say, Liberal Democrats in the government had a really strong record on carers. We passed the Carers Act of 2014, which would have really helped millions of people who have care, particularly elderly. And unfortunately, the Conservatives reneged on that Act of Parliament when they were a majority. So we have a good record, and we've been campaigning on this. We've been leading the political campaign on it. We're delighted that there is a review, that the attention is now on it, as we've been trying so hard to get. But I just worry that this review's got to be, you know, got to be timely. We can't see it put in the long grass. It's got to be broader. The minister, to be fair, Alison McGovern today, did respond positively to some of my questions, and I welcome that. But you can excuse me, I'm sure your listeners can excuse me, of being a little bit sceptical of reviews. We've heard it before so much in the last government. We need some action. The evidence, as I said to the Prime Minister earlier today, the evidence for this review is already there, established. It's in National Audit Office reports, it's in Select Committee reports. They need to take some decisions. They're fairly self-evident what they need to do. They should get on with it.
Sir Ed Davey, Leader of the Liberal Democrats, thanks very much. Now, in the past half hour, this year's winner of the prestigious Stirling Prize for Architecture has been announced, and it has been, as we heard in the news bulletin, awarded to London's Elizabeth Line, the judges hailing it as an extraordinarily complex architectural feat masked by an elegant simplicity. Well, our correspondent Ellie Price is at the Roundhouse in London, where the announcement has been made, and she joins us now. Ellie.
Yes, hello. Indeed, the most prestigious prize in British architecture, the Stirling Prize. It's been running since 1996. You may well have heard some of the previous winners, Hastings Pier, Gateshead Millennium Bridge, the Scottish Parliament, but also some buildings you may not have heard of. So, for example, last year, a retirement daycare centre in London won the gong. But yes, the Elizabeth Line in London, it's hard to have not heard about it. It was, of course, what was previously known as the Crossrail Project, 62 miles of railway mostly under London, commuting people from the east to the west and back again indeed. Now the judges called it a tour de force, a beautifully choreographed solution to inner city transport and a bold new standard for civic infrastructure. Joining me now is Muwa Oka, who's the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects. And first of all then, Muwa, why the Elizabeth Line? Why do they win?
Well, because it creates a 21st century experience. Stepping into it is like stepping into the future. And the way they've used slick, smooth series of architectural elements to create a customer experience, a traveller experience that is fit for the future. We believe it's an architecture for the digital age, in the way in which they use modern methods of construction, high quality and cutting edge industry techniques to deliver an architecture that is fit for the future.
Well, let's talk about some of those methods then with Neil McClements, who's one of the winners from Grimshaw Architects. What are you most proud of then as part of this prize?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things we're really proud about is just the reaction of Londoners to the new railway. Whenever it first opened, you could see people could sense there's a different experience here, you know, and I think the stations themselves are quite different to a typical underground station. They're twice the length, they're much bigger in the scale, but we were really conscious of that, and one of the things we wanted to do was to improve the experience for passengers deep underground.
Because one of the criteria was about accessibility, wasn't it, and inclusivity. So talk me through that briefly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think with the transport project now, you have to make sure that the stations are step-free, but we also tried to take it a bit further, thinking about different types of impairments in terms of mobility and also sensory impairments, but even neurodiversity. We did a lot of consultation with different accessibility groups through the development of the design, and this really led to a lot of refinements in the details.
Well, there you go. 700,000 passengers per week use the Elizabeth line, and the judges said that this changed commuter chaos and transformed it into an effortless experience. I think that's something to bear in mind for any London commuter using the Elizabeth line, and maybe a point of positivity to end on.
Ellie, many thanks. That was Ellie Price there speaking to one of the winners of the Stirling Prize, Neil McClements from Grimshaw Architects. We also heard from the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, Moira Oakey. And coming up later on The World Tonight, the composer Joanna McGregor on bringing a newly restored silent Sherlock Holmes film to life.
Sherlock Holmes himself, he's got a wonderful face. It's an older, handsome face, and he very often is frowning. So, of course, immediately you want to capture that as a musical colour.
Full interview later on.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
It is now 18 months since the civil war in Sudan began. The conflict in that northeast African country has left at least 20,000 people dead and, according to the United Nations, 25 million in dire need of humanitarian assistance. On one side is the Sudanese army and on the other the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a paramilitary group which evolved from the Janjaweed militia that was held responsible for mass killings in Sudan's Darfur region 20 years ago. The generals who lead these opposing forces supported the 2018 revolution that deposed Sudan's long-time dictator Omar al-Bashir, but they are now locked in a power struggle. It's been very difficult to report from Sudan since the civil war broke out, so when the BBC recently got access, it was particularly poignant for one London-based member of the team, Mohamed Hashim. He returned to the suburb of Khartoum called Omdurman, where he grew up. Here's his very personal report.
So I finally arrived in my neighborhood in Omdurman. Al-Morada Avenue is empty. The destruction is everywhere. Fronts of the houses are smashed. You can see the old slogans of the revolution are everywhere. I can see signs of the looting. Salaamu alaykum. So I just bumped into my neighbor, Haysam Shibeka. He's never left the neighborhood. And all the houses around him were occupied by the RSF. They were sleeping everywhere. And the extent of the devastation was total. Haysam lives opposite the masjid. We're now walking into the masjid for the prayer. The masjid appears to be fine. No signs of the destruction that you can see elsewhere.
Al-Hashmab is one of the old neighborhoods in the city. Our ancestors moved here in the late 19th century after they pledged allegiance to the Mahdi, the founder of Omdurman. My mother's grandfather built this mosque in the 1930s, and it is reassuring to come and find the faithful still hold their prayers here. It's strange to attend the mosque with so few people attending a Friday prayer, only three rows. I leave the mosque to visit my second cousin, Wafa.
She stayed alone in the house with a couple of ladies, and I don't know what she's going to tell me, and I don't think she's expecting me, so it's going to be a surprise for her. Assalamu alaikum.
وكلها كانت إرهاب وكلها كانت استغلال واستهداف وكلها كانت سرقة لأي شيء له معنى.
My aunt Wafa tells me of the ordeals they endured. She speaks of intimidation, theft, physical and verbal abuse and terror.
بعد كله شكل ونبذ وإرهاب.
It's good that I managed to come and visit my auntie Wafa. It's reassuring that she's managed to survive the worst month. But she's still standing. They've stolen everything she has, but she's relying on Allah and her faith.
It is time to see my house. This is possibly the hardest bit of this journey, visiting my family home where I grew up as a child.
I'm looking at the house before I go inside because I feel it's going to be heavy. Let's go into the house, I guess. Everything has been looted or destroyed or damaged.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Look at the destruction of it. Thank God that the pictures and the photographs are here. This is a diary of RSF soldiers stating the number of the force that was stationed here on the 3rd of October 2023. There were 35 RSF fighters here. The guy in charge, his name is Mahmoud, and what they had in terms of rations. Evidence of war. That's my father's PhD, a copy of it. And my grandmother's prayer beads. How is this war going to end? I don't know. Inshallah, God willing, one day we'll be able to come back. And the people who used to live here will try and build new lives.
The BBC's Mo Hashim. Well, Mo is now back in the UK. And when he came into the studio earlier this evening, he told me that the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, are not the only parties to this conflict accused of carrying out atrocities.
The UN fact-finding mission has said that both sides, the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Army, have committed war crimes. In the case of the Sudanese Army, it is accused of carrying out indiscriminate aerial bombardment, detention of civilians and torturing of detainees. Only last week we saw the bombing of a market in South Khartoum where 23 people were killed, I believe. While this is the case and this is the situation, I visited three cities this time around in Sudan. I met many people. Most of them have been impacted by what the RSF had done. And the situation in other parts of the country, whether it's in Darfur, where the RSF has been accused of carrying out a genocide, or whether it's in the center of the country in Al Jazeera state, which is the farming heartlands of Sudan, that has been extensively depopulated by the Rapid Support Forces, leading to failure of agricultural season. And when you speak to people on the ground, the one thing, and these are people living within army-controlled areas, the one thing that people say is we cannot live with the Janjaweed.
Where are the efforts to try and achieve a peace?
That's a good question. At the moment, it doesn't appear that there is going to be a breakthrough anywhere. Only last week, the commander of the Rapid Support Forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, accused Egypt of backing the Sudanese military, and he was seen to decry the defeats that his forces had had in recent weeks. On the other side, the Sudanese army has launched its largest offensive since the war started on the 26th of September in the Sudanese capital, and they've managed to cross from Omdurman on the west side into Khartoum North and Khartoum proper. So it appears that for now it's the guns that are doing the talking.
The BBC's Mo Hashim there. As we reported last night, a proposal to allow terminally ill adults in England and Wales the right to end their lives was introduced in Parliament today. Labour MP Kim Leadbeater's private member's bill is called the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. That we know. The text, though, it hasn't been published yet. Its broad parameters have, it will, quote, allow adults who are terminally ill, subject to safeguards and protections, to request and be provided with assistance to end their own life. Well, the parliamentary debate on this will begin at the end of November, but we have already been canvassing opinions. Arabella is one of the World Tonight listeners who have shared their views with us, and one of her our team has voiced up her words.
I'd like to share my experience of my partner's final years with you. Colin was the love of my life. We were partners for 43 years. For the last 18 years of his life, Colin suffered intermittent severe pain, and that, coupled with multiple disabilities and health problems, meant that his quality of life was sometimes very poor. We discussed how his suffering might be ended. I worked out how I could help him using the medication that had been prescribed for him and explained my plan. I told him that I would be willing to accept the risk of prosecution if he couldn't bear it any longer. It was a matter of principle for me. I could not stand by doing nothing in that situation. A month or so before his death, he asked me to go over the details of the plan with him again, which I did. I also said I wouldn't do it on a whim, because his moods were quite volatile. He'd have to be consistently certain for a week that this was what he wanted. But I repeated that if he did convince me that he felt that his life was no longer worth the struggle, I would end it for him. He found this promise very reassuring. He needed to know he had the choice, the option of freedom from pain. This helped him to bear it. I'm very glad to say that I never had to help Colin die. It happened naturally at home. It was a good death. I hope our story helps you to understand that the knowledge that there can be an escape from unbearable suffering can make life more bearable, even when it is very difficult. I want to have that choice myself, though I hope I never have to make it.
That was World Tonight listener Arabella. Well, last night we heard from Lauren Peters. She's a daughter of the late Tony Nicholinson, who had locked-in syndrome and who fought in the courts for the right to have doctors end his life. And from the Archbishop of Canterbury, he warned that in every place where this kind of legislation has been introduced, it has led to a slippery slope. Well, tonight, joining us in the studio, I'm pleased to say the actor, probably best known for her work in Silent Witness, and disability rights activist Liz Carr, who travelled to some of the places which have this assisted dying or assisted suicide legislation for a rather thought-provoking BBC documentary early this year called Better Off Dead, still available on BBC iPlayer. Welcome to the studio, Liz.
What a perfect plug. Thank you very
well,
much.
Well, I get them in early. I think that's nice good, isn't it? Yeah. Well, tell us about the slippery slope, as you would see it, that the Archbishop was talking about.
I'm not sure I see it as a slippery slope. I think I see it as an inevitability. I think that whenever there is an assisted suicide law, to a greater degree or lesser degree, there is always an extension. And an example of that is we're often told and talked about Oregon. Well, Oregon's very tightly restrained in its criteria. It's only for terminally ill people.
I think it's one of the 11 US states, isn't it?
That's right, that absolutely. Kind of because I oppose it, I'm always like, it's only 11 out of 50 states. There's the spin on it. But yeah, it's only 11. And but in Oregon, for example, what we've seen in recent years is the conditions have moved from like neuromuscular conditions like MND and cancer. It still includes that. But now things like arthritis, hernias, diabetes, and anorexia are in those lists. What's happening is that chronic illnesses are being included. But the country, that's the kind of the tight one, and I think that's still growing. That's chronic illnesses. But the country where it's really frightening for me and where I went to was Canada.
Because that has this two-track system now, doesn't it?
It does. It has track one, which is for people who are, you know, terminally ill. And that can be within 24 hours, they can be approved by two doctors and the proper criteria. But there's also now track two, which is when death is not immediately foreseeable, but for people that do have what's called intolerable suffering. you have to have a medical or health condition and then basically say, you know, it's causing such suffering that I want to end my life with medical assistance.
And is your objection, if you like, to that is that it is okay for someone to make that decision themselves that their suffering is intolerable, but you worry that others will make that decision for them?
I think that we talk a lot about choice, but we're not really in a position to offer people choice, real choice. Even in the
why do you say that?
Well, I think when I look at what's happening in Canada, let's talk about them before we come back to the UK, there are increasing numbers of cases of disabled people, people who are intolerably suffering, I would define them as disabled people, choosing it because they don't have access to accessible housing or pain control or social care. So somebody used it because they couldn't get out of hospital.
And just bluntly, would you come into this category?
Absolutely, I would. Absolutely. You know, and I just want to say, I'm a control freak, okay? I really am. I want an escape route. I want to know how to get out. I do understand that. And what I think can be a freedom and feel like an insurance for many people, for those of us that come under these laws all the time, potentially at all times, it feels like a potential sword of Damocles. Because if your care package is cut, if your life becomes distressing, if your partner dies, whatever it is, whatever reason, it does not have to be linked to your medical condition. You can use medically assisted suicide in Canada. And the fear is, why wouldn't that happen here?
Liz Carr, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. As I said, Better Off Dead? It's on BBC iPlayer. And please keep sending your comments and experiences on this issue. Lots of opinions out there. We'll aim to share as many as we can on air. You can email us world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. You can use WhatsApp. The number is 03700 100 444. Or you can send us a text on 84844. But do bear in mind your phone service provider may charge you for that.
Mr. Holmes?
Hello. I was studying the faces of our fellow passengers. Fascinating hobby, and sometimes most enlightening.
Oh, Watson. Upon my word, I thought you were too busy to come and see me anymore.
Well, I have been rather busy, I confess.
Oh, if you find your own cases more interesting than mine.
I am suggesting that it bears some of the hallmarks of Professor Moriarty's work.
Imagine someone's going to get murdered at a wedding. Who exactly would you pick?
I think you're a popular choice at the moment, dear.
Someone could move Mrs. Hudson's glass just slightly out of reach. That would be lovely.
Some of the many voices of Sherlock Holmes down the years. Basil Rathbone, Carlton Hobbs, the radio version, Jeremy Brett and Benedict Cumberbatch there. Well, this evening, three newly restored silent films featuring Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's famous detective have been shown at Alexandra Palace, their first screening in a century. The three of them, A Scandal in Bohemia, The Golden Pince-Nez and The Final Problem, were part of a much bigger series that were made in the early 1920s. They have been accompanied by a live score, specially composed and performed by the Royal Academy of Music Soloists Ensemble, conducted by Joanna McGregor. As the final rehearsals were taking place, I went along to the Royal Academy of Music, conveniently a stone's throw from Baker Street, to speak to Joanna McGregor and to Bryony Dixon, who's curator of silent film at the BFI National Archive, where the films were restored.
Every age has its own Sherlock Holmes, and during the silent era, the 1920s in particular, there was only one Sherlock Holmes of real note, who was Eily Norwood. And he is a great actor who's mainly did stage work, but he took up film quite early on, and he's got great gravitas, I think. He does a kind of naturalistic acting style which is understated. So he's not the bipolar Holmes. He is very much, you know, the rather sort of dignified, clever, intellectual Holmes.
And a favourite of Conan Doyle?
Conan Doyle, yes, because this was really one of the few Sherlock Holmes that Conan Doyle actually saw and had experience of. And he liked him a lot. Eily Norwood looks great, even though he's older than the kind of Holmes that we're used to these days. So he was about 59 when he started playing Holmes, but he looks perfect, actually. He models himself on the Sidney Paget illustrations from the Strand magazine stories, and he really looks the part. You know, he's got the smoking jacket, the pipe, and so on.
Deerstalker?
No deerstalker, no.
And no sound to go with it. So these were silent films. They weren't lost, but they have had to be restored, is that right?
Yes, exactly. They were sort of preserved, but we didn't have copies that were screenable to the public. But now we're in the digital age, we can do a lot more to bring the images back to life. We can remake the intertitles, which, you know, supply the words of the story, and we can marry them up with live music as they would have been performed in the cinemas of the 1920s. So no silent film was ever actually silent. It had music. This supplied the essential emotion and dynamic structure that brings the pictures alive.
And you have supplied the cue to bring in Joanna at this point to talk about the music and tell us how you approached scoring the music.
It is an amazing thing to forensically study a silent film and try and work out what you're going to do at any point. They're quite long scenes, so you have to figure out a way of creating music that can follow a lot of talking and a lot of interesting looking. As Brian, you were saying, it's very understated and very classy. I would say this is a really classy Sherlock Holmes. He's actually very handsome and rather serious and rather patrician. I think he's great. His foil, of course, is Watson, who is constantly trying to look after him in a very tender way, actually. It's one of the great bromances, I think.
And that comes out of the music?
Yes, I have written a little love song for Watson and Holmes, which, of course, the audience might not notice.
And is it from scratch? Because Bryony was saying these films were not shown without scores, but there's no original score to work from.
It's completely from scratch. Mostly in the old days, people would sit there and improvise. They wouldn't write anything down. And I've done a lot of improvising to silent film in the past, and it's been great. However, scoring is much more hard work because you've really got to start and stop in the right place and make a decision about your speeds and capture the essence of the scene.
So how do you go about bringing alive an actor on the screen in music?
Well, interestingly, we're working with an ensemble of 10, and just in that small ensemble, we've got a lot of different colours. We've got brass, woodwind, strings, piano, celeste, percussion, marimba. And in one sense, you want to decide what your colour might be, your atmosphere. So, for example, Sherlock Holmes himself, he's got a wonderful face. It's an older, handsome face, and he very often is frowning. So, of course, immediately you want to capture that as a musical colour, and you might decide to use lower strings or something a bit dark. And then as soon as there's a nightclub raid or a police raid or something like that goes on, you're going to do different kind of music, you know. So straight away you're thinking about colour, tempo, surprise harmonies, you know.
So you've got the Reichenbach Fools.
Yes, but in this version it's the Cheddar Gorge they go to. Because obviously at the time they didn't have the budget.
So final thought, three down. How many more to go?
Another 42.
42. Yeah, you're laughing, Joanna. You want to take on more bromance and excitement and adventure and problem solving?
Well, I'm sort of hooked now. Actually, I've been hooked in by these films. I think they look gorgeous. And I'm very, very, you know, in love with this actor playing Sherlock Holmes. He's marvellous.
I can tell. And we heard there from Joanna McGregor, who's head of piano at the Royal Academy of Music. She also composed the score for one of those three silent films. And Bryony Dixon from the BFI National Archive. They were speaking to me ahead of tonight's premiere of Silent Sherlock, Three Classic Cases. Now, just before we go, a quick look at tomorrow's front pages. The Daily Telegraph's headline is Budget to be biggest tax raiser in history. The paper says the Chancellor may look to raise fuel duty and faces backlash from Cabinet colleagues. Well, the Times also leads on budget speculation. It says Rachel Reeves will raise capital gains tax on share sales. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami for now from all of us here. Good night.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation. and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.